Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you're calling in from the world. My name is Rahul Brown, and I'm delighted to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it's a conversation we're having with ourselves or others. Across time and culture, these stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and our minds. So the purpose of our weekly Awaken Calls is to share stories from incredible change makers around the globe. Through our thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions and their experiences, as well as their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant the seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold the space, and we're just so grateful to everyone who, including all of our listeners, who co-create this space to make these calls possible. Today, we are immensely grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us. Mark Whittell is actually joining us from New Zealand, where I believe it's 4 a.m., and his personal journey is not only tremendously inspiring, but has had a huge impact on many people around the world. Thank you all again for joining us for today's call. Let's start with just 1 minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Mark Whittell. So here's how the flow of our call is going to work. In a few minutes, our moderator, Fabrizio, will engage in a deep dialogue with Mark. And at the top of the hour, we're going to switch over into Q&A and Circle of Sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. The queue is currently open, so at any point, you can actually hit *6 on your phone and be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org. This week's theme, as I shared earlier, is the heart of yoga. And, you know, my understanding of the heart of yoga is really the inner core of the understanding, that part of it which is beyond the wrappings of culture that touch the unique universal aspect of what the discovery and the practice of yoga is, and how it relates to our bodies and our minds. And we have the great pleasure of having Fab here with us as well, who is no stranger to yoga. Fab is himself a yoga teacher and among many other things. So Fab, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to hear your brief reflections on our theme as well before we launch into the conversation with Mark.
Well, thank you, Rahul. It's a pleasure to be here. My relationship with yoga goes back to my first teacher training when actually the book that Mark edited and helped to publish and bring to the world was the main text in our teacher training. So I'm very, very much looking forward to talking to Mark today. The perception that I think is out there of yoga in general, I think, is a bit limited. Yoga is a very big practice. It's one of the oldest spiritual practices in the world, and it's got a very rich history that's very open-hearted and full-hearted. So I look forward to getting into the heart of it with Mark.
Wonderful. So why don't we just perhaps just transition over then to that conversation with Mark, since I know that there are a lot of folks who have dialed in specifically to hear this discussion. Would you like to give a brief introduction to Mark?
I would. So Mark Whitwell was born in New Zealand to parents of English descent, where he was influenced by the indigenous Maori culture in New Zealand, which makes up 20% of the population there. He's now a U.S. citizen, making his home in Berkeley, California, where I happen to be right now. He also likes to say he's Fijian, as he has a retreat center on the island of Tabiuni, where he runs his teacher training programs. But I think it's safe to say that of all of Mark's cultural influences, his connection to India has made the most profound impact on him, the way he's lived his life and the way he's made his mark in the world, pun intended. Of all the world's great wisdom traditions, ancient Indian knowledge, which today expresses itself in many forms, including yoga, has the deepest roots. Yoga, as part of the longest continually running spiritual tradition in the world, risks drying up and becoming irrelevant unless it's nurtured along the way by great spirits and learned scholars who are committed to keeping its wisdom alive and relevant by demonstrating its timeless benefits while continually updating its practices to fit changing cultural contexts. One of those great scholars, of course, is Tirumalai Krishnamacharya, who was born in Mysore in India in 1888 and lived for just over a century. He was known throughout India as a gifted healer, drawing from both Ayurveda and yoga traditions and methods, but he's known the world over as the father or the grandfather of modern yoga and the architect of the vinyasa style of practice. He's credited with reviving hatha yoga practices, which had been marginalized at the end of the 19th century. He brought the practices out of the caves of the Himalayas and gave them a new life and legitimacy while passing them on in different forms to his many students, some of whom became even better known than Krishnamacharya himself by taking the teachings around the world. People like Indra Devi, A.G. Mohan, B.K.S. Iyengar, Patabi Joyce, and Krishnamacharya's own son, T.K.V. Desikachar. They all learned their particular version of yoga from the great master. In 1973, Mark had the great fortune of being invited into the home of Krishnamacharya and Desikachar, which began a profound personal learning journey lasting over 20 years, the ripples of which can still be felt by thousands across the globe. Many of those ripples were created by a book he first suggested to Desikachar and eventually edited and contributed to, this 1995 book entitled The Heart of Yoga, Developing a Personal Practice, represented the first time the teachings of Krishnamacharya and Desikachar would be presented directly to the Western practitioner rather than through an interpreting teacher. Its importance is evidenced by the fact that it formed the basis of many yoga teacher training programs, including my first training many years ago. Since that time, Mark has taught yoga throughout the US, Asia, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, continuing to focus on teaching in a way that allows each individual to find their own yoga appropriate for their own particular physical, mental, emotional, and cultural context. He has published two of his own books, Yoga of Heart, The Healing Power of Intimate Connections, and The Promise of Love, Sex, and Intimacy, as well as DVDs, audio recordings, and even a couple of apps to help people commit to their practice. You can access all these resources and more at his website, heartofyoga.org, where you can learn about and contribute to Heart of Yoga's Peace Project, which now seeds yoga teachers and communities in conflict zones worldwide. We have lots to talk about, and so it gives me great pleasure to welcome all the way from New Zealand, where I understand it's 4 o'clock in the morning, Mark Whitwell. Welcome, Mark.
Wow. There's nothing more to say, Fab. That is quite wonderful.
Well,
All
right, then.
You've given a very tidy summary there.
Okay. So are you one of these stereotypes? Are you a stereotypical yogi that gets up at 4 o'clock every day anyways and does a 3-hour practice?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The hour of God.
Mm-hmm.
A yogi gets up and does his puja and meditation and asana pranayama contemplation right now. This is what I'm doing right now with you.
Exactly. And not only is it pretty much the middle of the night, but it's also the middle of winter there. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's not so bad. I just came down from Fiji. I came down from Los Angeles, and we did a 3-week teacher training. And thanks for mentioning Tabiuni, Fiji, this beautiful multicultural country. And we had a gathering there that we called Fiji Spirit Gathering. It was intended to bring yoga to the Fijian, the indigenous people of Fiji, as well as the Indian population that was brought into Fiji for 5 generations ago by the British to cut the sugar cane. So half the population is actually Indian Hindu, which is makes Fiji a very interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had our event there, and I came down from New Zealand 3 days ago, and it's not so bad. It's not so cold. It's rather pleasant,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Oh, great.
For a little bit. Go ahead.
Great. I remember going to Fiji way back in 1992 and spending a little bit of time on an island called Tavewa, which was a very tiny island, still running the traditional method. They had a king, and they had a couple of dozen people living there and lived off of what they could catch in the water. I'm curious about this gathering that you had, because I've also taught yoga in Canada, where I'm from, to indigenous communities there, and it seems to be there's quite an overlap between kind of the indigenous population seems to get yoga at a deep core level. Is that what you found in Fiji as well?
Yeah, and of course a great need for it because of the lifestyle habits that have crept in more modern times, and the impact of white colonialism and the complexities and the impositions that has caused to the indigenous societies. And I think too that yoga, of course, is shamanic in its roots. You know, it began as shamanic activity in early human societies, and so that their natural understanding of the land and the people, the land and the sky and the oceans are one. that's intrinsic to who they are. So they take to yoga quite naturally, actually. And of course, going right to the subject of yoga, is that it was one of the great 6 ancient darshanas of the ancient world that was independent of all the other darshanas. It was universal to all language groups and all cultures, all religious points of view, and yet it was used by all language groups and cultures and points of view as a practical means to actualize the idealisms of culture. So that's why it went right through the ancient world as something very useful and survived through many, many generations to modern times, because it's extremely useful to all people, you know, like such as indigenous people around the world and people with spiritual needs and intentions and spiritual language, religious language, religious thought structure. Yoga is needed as the practical means to actualize their cultural idealisms. I don't know if that makes sense what I'm saying. This is why yoga is going through the modern world, because it's very helpful to all people,
mm-hmm.
no matter what their cultural point of view is. So I, like in Fiji, I'm really happy now. We've done it for a few years, a little more expanded this year, and what has naturally happened is that yoga has gone to Fijian people who now have it and are teaching on their own accord. You know, like you say, that the garden is growing in its own way. where the ground is nurtured and yoga is growing in that culture through good people. So sincere people taking it on, and Fijian people. So this is what I'm loving seeing is it moving in its own accord, not dependent on me or even my students, my Western students. It's just going, which is very good to see. Same in Japan. We've been in Japan for a few years now, and it's got a great growth of its own, independent of me going there or my friends going there to teach.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the wonderful thing about yoga, is that it has, there's a common seed, but the way that it blooms is quite different in each individual and each individual culture. And so I thought we would start with, because, you know, I really love how most of your most recent work centers around yoga as intimacy, because yoga really is intimacy. It's a chance to be intimate with ourselves, with our own personal histories, and with our own personal conditions at this time, and get real about things and go deep. And so I'd like to spend a little bit of time here to give people a bit of context of your own story and how that seed got planted in you and how it's blossomed over the years. So you're obviously from New Zealand, born of English parents, and both your parents were educators. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were. They were school teachers. And, my father ran a teacher training college for many years. And mm-hmm. So this whole teaching thing, I suppose, is my blood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And back then, and even now today, I think there's quite a difference between the regimented teaching that many of us experience versus the kind of teaching that we strive for in yoga.
Yeah. The understanding, of course, in yoga, in the Yoga Sutra, is that yoga must be adapted to the situation. So there's, you know, the hallmark of Krishnamacharya's teaching. And thanks for introducing the whole subject so well, Bab. I appreciate it. Krishnamacharya, as a scholar of the Veda, a scholar of the great tradition, and a yogi, he was emphatic that technically yoga must be adapted to the needs of each person. And his statement is that there is a right yoga for each person, no matter who the person is. That is their direct, is that individual's direct intimacy with reality itself, life itself, which is a nurturing force. Life is nurturing. Life is regenerating. That's what we are. And yoga is the connection to that, the embrace of that. However, it is not a standardized system. It is not a linear process of trying to get to yoga. Yoga is simply each individual's participation in the given reality, life itself. So the needs of the individual are taken into account, and that is the individual's body type, age, health, and, very importantly, the cultural background of each person. So the thought structures by which people live their lives in their societies must be taken into account, and yoga adapted to that, to the cultural background of each person. So that's why yoga is not some stylized system, one size fits all, that creates this sort of linear effort in the body and mind to conform to a future result or conform to some sort of idealism. You're not trying to get anywhere in yoga. You are simply participating in life itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, as I understand it, your first encounter with yoga came by participating in kind of a normal life in your upbringing in New Zealand. And I gather you were on track to become a school teacher yourself and spend some time actually being a school teacher. And then I've heard stories of the Beatles kind of waking you up to this other reality in India. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I so appreciate that you've sort of looked into this and can bring it all forth and get me to talk about it at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Okay. Well, you're welcome
really.
To say no.
No, it is my duty. There's an opportunity to talk for me to talk about yoga and Krishnacharya and my teachers, of course. What an offer. And yes, you know, like growing up in the suburban lifestyle that America offered and offers its citizens, it became clear to me, you know, quite early on, as you know, 16, 17 year old boy in the suburbs in the high school, that there seemed to be a lack of information, a lack of life choices, and a natural sort of a frustration of growing more and needing more. The great, you know, inquiry into, you know, like, what's going on? What's this all about? You know,
mm-hmm.
And I actually did, my parents were very sort of upright citizens and educators, and the whole sort of idealism of, you know, going to, doing well at school and then going on to university and getting your qualifications, getting ready for the future universities or the future factories, you know, that being productive was what it's all about. And I went into university, and I feel very fortunate to be, you know, growing into you know, early adulthood at that time where there was this extraordinary explosion of Western popular culture with the whole thing of music and everything. You know, we must acknowledge the great migration of out of Africa to America, and the music that it carried and the blues that it carried, you know, before even recorded music. This is what it's based upon. And then that coming into white audiences through radio and through Elvis, you know, thank God for Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Lennon hearing Elvis and saying, hey, that's what I want to do, you know?
Right.
And, John Lennon, you know, and then the rest is history. But, you know, me as a young boy wondering about life, and then suddenly the Beatles and, you know, me at the sort of pinnacle of my youthful inquiry, and then there are the Beatles, and the women started screaming in Liverpool and New York, you know, to that explosion of consciousness. And I, you know, I have to say though, it was like the intensity of their own personal journey and inquiry, and then going to Rishikesh, going to India and meeting a yogi, Mahesh Yogi, the founder of TM, and studying with him and just letting their personal journeys be known to the rest of the world. And, you know, so there I am as a young guy going, wow, that's kind of cool. That's interesting. And seeing all the images of yoga and the, you know, the cross-legged sages, and that was information for me that I never got through my schooling system. No one was talking to me about Eastern philosophy or anything like that. and they're still not.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the meditation seems to be making its way through the school systems and some places, a little bit of yoga here and there, but it definitely could use a little bit more propagation.
I could say it's in the public domain a little bit, it's something of a dialogue, you know, people hear about yoga and meditation and so on. But just to reflect on that you know, my grandfather, your grandfather and father, no doubt, you know, like, what did they have to do? You know, my father was through World War II and so forth, and World War I and II were raging in that dreadful dark time in Europe and the rest of the world. And at that same time, on the continent of India, were people like Ramana Maharishi or Bhagavan Nityananda and Shirdi Sai Baba and, you know, Ananda Mai Ma, Neem Karoli Baba, you know, to name a handful top of mind. In the sublimity of human possibility, having their lives really, like actually there, in human acknowledgement, realization of what is of reality itself, life itself, as perfect, intrinsic harmony with the universe. There they were in the natural state, while Europe developed its colonialism and destruction of indigenous societies all around the world, and then the strife of world wars, and that's what we were born into. Mm-hmm. And then John Lennon comes along and says, "Give peace a chance." Thank God. And that was then delivered on through music and media, global media. And I, you know, I'm still saying it's the worst of times at the best of times that we have now, because we're all utterly interconnected in this, you know, second brain that we have, this global interconnectedness as a brain. And I think there is a chance now to communicate more clearly, more robustly to the whole world. You know, apparently, like, everybody's getting a smartphone. Even poor people are going to get smartphones in the next 5 or 10 years. And we can deliver now into the world these simple principles of how to be connected, how to be intimate with reality itself, the power of this cosmos that is arising as each and every person, you know, in perfect harmony with the rest of existence, which is what life is doing. So there's great hope, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you experienced that when you were, so you first made your way to India in the early 1970s, and you ended up at the ashram of Ramana Maharishi, and you described him as the source of life itself, as the power of creation as a human being, even though he had already died at that point. And you felt the great silence of Arunachala. And so that, can you describe just the feeling sense that you got once you got to India and you actually started to breathe the air and start to tap into that energy there?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what?
Let's have a minute of silence right now. That's so beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you met a friend who was studying with Desikachar and Krishnamurti, and you ended up actually meeting them alongside some other great spiritual figures of the time, J. Krishnamurti and U.G. Krishnamurti, who, for some people who may not know, they are not related, but they were friends and they did have a dialogue for much of their lives. But What I find interesting about that is that you were kind of thrown into this mix, in this, you know, this cauldron, if you will, of the many different influences from Krishnamacharya, drawing from, he was a very learned scholar in many disciplines of yoga, and also from these other luminaries who were coming at it from more of the mind ground, if you will. Both J. Krishnamurti and U.G. Krishnamurti didn't really subscribe to any particular tradition, but they were mostly concerned with the mind. And so I'm wondering what it felt like to be kind of in that soup, if you will, in that intersection of these, you know, coming at it from the body, if you will, from the Hatha Yoga tradition, from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, yeah. And this other side of things. What was that like to be in that atmosphere?
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, thanks for bringing all of them forth for our consideration. And just going to the environment of Ramana Maharishi, they say that Ramana was like a white spot on the white page of the great tradition of India, that he was the culmination or a tangible realizer of the great tradition of the ancient world in modern times. And it's a very sort of curious thing that it seems like if anyone has fallen into, you know, complete identification with the power of the cosmos, you know, not obstructed in the body and mind from the power of creation, that person becomes very useful to others, so that all other people can experience, realize their intrinsic identity with the power of creation as being at one with the universe as it is. And a curious matter is that when that person dies, that there's a continuity of their personal presence and availability in the places where they lived and in the murtis, the images of their life. And that was certainly my experience in Tiruvannamalai, in this sacred mountain called Arunachala. They call the Mount Kailash of the holy mountain of southern India. And to this day, it's quite a lovely place. But I always like to point out, of course, that is the understanding and the experience and the advantage of, say, the Christian world, is there is that matter of Christ is that personal appearance of somebody who is not separate from the power of creation. And that's a great guru culture that has been useful, it seems. We're not talking about religious belief systems or the overlay of social patterning and social impositions and sort of the whole idea of religion as a power structure is obviously to be transcended in one's relationship with one's guru. so anyway, it was my experience there in southern India, and I'm very grateful to that visit, because then I was able to meet a wonderful friend. His name is Douglas Rosestone. He was a young boy. He was in Ramana's ashram, and he'd been with J. Krishnamurti, and he was studying with Dasavacharya and Krishnamacharya. So he was my intro into 3 hours north to Madras, and I met my teachers there. So there is this... I studied there since 1973, for a long, long time, and it was a wonderful time. And in the, as you mentioned, in the mix of those personalities in that study, there was the ever presence of Jay Krishnamurti and his friend Eugene Krishnamurti. And you're right, they're not related. Krishnamurti is like, you know, there's 5 pages of Krishnamurti in the Madras phone book. It's like Smith. And so they're not related, but they were good friends. And they, Jay Krishnamurti, of course, had been selected by Theosophy as being their world leader. He was just a young boy on the beach in Madras, and he was recognized and became schooled and educated in Theosophy. And but the big story, of course, is that he grew up in that worldwide community as their leader, and then walked out of it saying, no, this is nonsense. And the great statement from Jay Krishnamurti is that truth is a pathless land. There is no path to truth. There's no path required to truth, because truth is the all-pervading present. You know, here is truth in my hand, in life itself. There's no, the, you cannot get to truth. There's no requirement to get to truth. And so that was the great statement from J.K., Judu Krishnamurti. And he became a close friend of Krishnamacharya, because in his elderly life, he became interested in yoga. He had health needs in his elderly life, and some of his senior students, particularly Banda Scarabelli, a wonderful Iyengar yoga teacher in Italy, and she was principally a friend and student of Jay Krishnamurti, and they had these grand meetings in Europe and in Switzerland and Zanin every year. Jay Krishnamurti came to a big, big tent, and all the theosophists who stayed, of course, friends and interested in what J.K. was bringing forth, they would all come and meet in Europe. And in that time, in his elderly life, he wasn't so well, and Banda Scarabelli brought Mr. Iyengar into that environment, and he started teaching yoga classes, so J.K. got interested in yoga. But his health apparently didn't pick up, and on one of his visits to Adyar, the home of Theosophy in Madras, the headquarters, he went and saw Krishnamacharya, and because he was acquainted with him, well, in fact, they were friends, and he said, can you help me? And Krishnamacharya said, yes, I can help you, and I'll have my son teach you. And Desikachar started teaching Krishnamacharya at that point, and it was a wonderful experience for the young Desikachar, because J.K. is very famous, and he was totally struck at Krishnamurti's diligence in being a good yoga student, and became very enthusiastic on the subject. And Desikachar said that he helped me get, Krishnamurti helped me become a good teacher, a good student of my own father, a good student of yoga. And until then, Desikachar was a little reluctant about, because he was a brilliant young man. He was an engineer working for a German yoga, a German engineering company. And he was a little reluctant to leave that career. But then, having gone to the West, to Switzerland, to teach J.K. there, he suddenly like dived in, and he realized the importance of what he held. And just to me, Desikachar, who just died last year, you know, he was a brilliant person, and he was really the person that brought forth the teachings of Krishnamacharya in a way that the Western mind could understand. And Desikachar pays tribute to Jay Krishnamurti, because he said that it was Krishnamurti taught him everything about the West. He taught him how to eat with a knife and fork, you know, in Switzerland, and understand the Western mind. So it was that teamwork of Krishnamurti and Yaskachar that brought the clarity. See, Krishnamacharya he wasn't a speaker of English, and he was quite elderly. You know, he lived to 101 years old and died in 1989. But, you know, he was quite an elderly chap who never left India, couldn't speak English, a deep scholar of his ancient tradition. But, you know, without that, the transmission and translation from Dasgupta, he'd be impossible for a Western mind to understand. So it was J.K. and Dasgupta who brought the clarity of what Krishnamacharya's understandings, realization was. And so I was around with all those people. And then the great blast of Yuji Krishnamurti was there too. So Yuji was a very interesting phenomena, but he was a friend of J.K. and for 17 years he was a student of J.K. in that whole development of J.K. as a teacher, with saying, going around saying truth is a pathless land. But J.K. was nevertheless up there on a chair as the speaker, trying to get his audience to understand what the hell he was talking about, in some kind of sublime state of consciousness realization. And it wasn't until late in his life that he discovered yoga. And so I'm saying, you know, it's not good enough to have somebody in this, you know, the idea of the perfected person on a stage, like a special person, cajoling the audience, the worldwide audience, to now be in the state that he or she is in. Simply that there must be a yoga. For personal empowerment, there must be a practical means that each and every person can actually do that is their connection to life itself, to the natural state that the speaker is in. And without a yoga, then you turn even that state into a something that's not yet attained, that people are trying to get to. You know, and Jay Krishnamurti going to Ojai in California, living there for 30 years, and he did create a sort of society around him of frustrated seekers trying to be in the state that he was talking about and apparently in. And it was only, you know, I'm saying he got yoga, but he got it too late in his life, and he couldn't sort of bring it into what he was offering his people. And I'm saying that it is a clear requirement in this vast tradition of having a helpful teacher in a state of sublimity, and you want to be in that state. Sure, the teacher is helpful, but then the response to the teacher and response to the teaching and response to the state that you know to be there as a possibility for yourself, but there are these obstructing patterns in the body and mind, this contraction in the body and mind that's there. And there must be this sort of like steady, easy yogic response to what you feel, what has inspired you in the company of a great teacher or a great teaching like that. And it was, so Yuji was on the side of this whole thing where he was in the tent in Zanon, having been a dutiful friend and student of Jay Krishnamurti for 17 years, and he was just sitting there, and he suddenly, like, the thought came to in his mind, he said, that I'm in the state, I am in the state that he is talking about. And so he was saying, what am I doing here in this dynamic of trying to get to that state when I'm already in that state, you know, the natural state of life itself that everybody is actually in, you know. So he walked out of that tent and realized that he didn't have to be in that sort of thought structure, that dynamic of trying to get somewhere when he was already somewhere. And he reported that this huge explosion of energy of life itself came into him and looked after him from then on. And he didn't have to be in that dynamic any longer of trying to be with the great teacher, trying to get somewhere as if he wasn't somewhere. So
that's the great trap.
That's the great trap that many of us get into. Yeah, the social dynamic of disempowerment is this special teacher who's in a special place, and you're trying to get to that special place. Yeah, and the sad thing for humanity is that whole phenomena has been created as a power mechanism, as a social structure of power. You know, it's actually even created civilization, where we are the whole model of the perfect person implies that you're not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
The model of the perfectity that believes itself to be not yet perfect. You know, these neat packages trying to get perfect through religion and yoga and meditation and everything else. You know, we are life itself. What is life? You know, it's a pure intelligence presently arising as the whole body. And the whole body is in intrinsic and perfect harmony with everything else existing, you know, with light, with the sun, with air. This whole body is in perfect harmony with air and the green realm, the plant kingdom, and, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars and Mother Earth. It's already established, is in utter harmony. And that's what the situation is. That's the fact of the situation. You don't have to get to it. You are it. We are, and there's no getting to it. This great statement from Jay Krishnamurti, truth is a pathless land. There is no getting to it. You don't have to get to it. You are it. And then yoga arises merely as your perfect participation in this that is given, this that we are. And that's the great thing that Krishnamacharya and Jay Krishnamurti and Yuji Krishnamurti left. They clarified yoga for the rest of time, really, for humanity. And the yoga is not this sort of cleaving to some future state, some work on yourself to get to some future possibility. Sort of manipulating your body and mind towards some future result. That's gone now. We're good now.
Mm-hmm.
We're good to go. We are life itself, and we have our yogas of direct intimacy with life itself. It's clarified the whole situation. So you see, Yuji was the, as it has been in human history, the spiritual. Teachers often come in pairs, you know, like John the Baptist and Christ, or, you know, Ramakrishna and Sarada, Aurobindo and the Mother and so forth, Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, like that. So it was Jay Krishnamurti and Yuji Krishnamurti, and like that. And Yuji in particular, he was really close to Krishnamacharya because he went through his sort of great explosion of, you know, whatever happened to him. And Dasagachar and he had become really close friends because they were both in the Zanon gatherings with Jay Krishnamurti over years. And so when this happened to Yuji, when he walked out of the tent and realized that he was already in the natural state, and that this explosion of light through him was a little uncomfortable sometimes. And he went to Dasgupta and said, can you help me in this? And he said, Dasgupta said, well, you know, there's one person that can help you, and it's my father. So Yuji also went to Krishnamacharya and studied yoga with him for the next 3.5 years. And they became very close, and much love and respect for each other, although they were quite different people from different backgrounds. And this culminated in Yuji clarifying yoga's excuse me, you were saying that, you know, yoga is not this imposition on the body and mind. And he really sort of held Krishnamacharya to the fire of his own teaching, and that is yoga must be adapted perfectly to each individual, that the individual's yoga practice is only participation in life, and not a manipulation of the pranas, not a manipulation of the body and its energies, but participation, that the prana or life has its own intelligence, knows exactly what it's doing. You are each looked after by the intelligence of life.
Mm-hmm. And I'm struck by the fact that even today, like you say, we're good now, and I totally get it. I understand that the language that you're speaking, and it's very much looking at yoga from the tantric perspective versus the classical yoga perspective. And you've mentioned in the past that even Krishnamacharya was toxified by this male Brahmin search, by this kind of idea that some future self is going to be better than the current self, and the conditions in the future are going to be better, and so on.
Exactly.
But I wonder this is what I struggle with as a teacher myself is, you know, I love your Instagram feed because there are zero pictures of you doing handstands and, you know, fancy yoga poses. And yet most of the yoga world today is just littered with this kind of idea that, you know, this idealized self includes all these gymnastic capabilities and all the rest of it. And so, yes, it requires a lot of work to get there. And we can talk for hours as to whether or not that's, you know, an accurate reflection of yoga in any shape or form. But what I appreciate about your teachings, from what I understand, is that they are based in Tantra. And Tantra is a very, very different philosophical ground than classical yoga. And so I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of, first of all, how do you incorporate Tantra into your teachings? And how do you really think that we're good now, that we can kind of rely on the progress that we've made so far and move forward from there? Or where's the work that still needs to be done in the general population?
Beautiful.
And Mark, before you answer that question, this is Rahul. Sorry, I just wanted to remind folks on the call that we're close to the top of the hour. So if you do have your own questions for Mark, please press *6 to get in the queue, and we'll just take them after Mark's response to this wonderful question on Tantra that I've just asked. Go ahead, Mark.
Awesome. Thanks, Rahul. Yeah, awesome. So, yeah, we're definitely good now. We're life itself. Well, you know, the universe is good. Humanity might have a problem, but the universe is just fine, you know. The universe is a constant restoring, regenerating system. If humanity destroys itself, that the universe will continue on in great, utter perfection and harmony, you know. So humanity can get aligned now to the power of this universe that brought us forth and presently sustains us, you know, and we can cooperate with that. Let's all get busy in that cooperation with the ecology of this universe, and let's all survive. Sustainability begins with your own embodiment and your own intimacy with reality itself, and we can extend that to the whole of humanity and look after this ecology of Mother Earth, and we might get through this. So, yeah, we're definitely good now. We're good to go. We have yoga clarified from the great tradition by Krishnamacharya and Yuji Krishnamurti in particular, as each and every individual's direct intimacy with life itself. So the power of the cosmos is arising as each and every person, as a pure intelligence and utter beauty. Everything in the natural world is utterly beautiful. It is the beauty, life itself, the beauty. And we are that. We are that. It's just a fact. You don't have to get to it. We are it. There's no getting to it. The imposition of having to get to it is the problem itself. So, you know, as Yuji would say, stop looking, start living, start the connection, the embrace to what is. And as I said, the body is in a perfect harmony with air and light. and green realm, you know, and the source of it all that brings it, sustains it all. And yoga is that participation. Just to be very clear about it, is that if you're involved in any asana postures, you know, the whole busyness of the American studio yoga, that is tantra. The asana is hatha yoga. Hatha yoga is the mother's milk of tantra. So asana is tantric practice. What is tantra? Direct intimacy with reality itself. And this is what we're doing. So if we put in the principles of hatha yoga, of the non-dual tantra of direct intimacy with reality itself, it is only a nurturing force. You put these principles into what has been popularized as yoga. So I'm saying the principles of Krishnamacharya that he brought forth from the great tradition. He didn't make it up. He brought it forth as a scholar, clarified by Eugene Krishnamurti to make sure it was each person's perfect participation in the weapon. Then you're good. You're good to go. And as I said, this hatha is the perfect union of opposites. Hatha, sun and moon, male and female. Strength that is receiving. Exhale with inhale in your own embodiment. And that's the whole point of asana. You do asana for this participation in the union of strength that is receptive, that is the inhale and the exhale. So when you make the breath the central principle or the central feature and even purpose of the asana, asana is not there for its own sake to look good for your Instagram photo. Asana is there to bring that, participate in that merge of exhale with inhale, of strength, which is the exhale, to inhale the receptivity. And that develops that receptivity, strength that is utterly receptive as the natural form of life. That's what life is. It is this yin-yang, strength receiving, male, female, perfect collaboration of life that is the power of this cosmos and the nurturing, regenerating, generating force of this cosmos is the male, female, perfect collaboration as equals and opposites, where one opposite empowers the other opposite, literally so. You know. And this is Hatha Yoga, and it's available for everybody. The point being that the asana is designed for each person according to their body type, age, and health, so that it is actually hatha yoga. And it might look like Mr. Iyengar's postures. There's nothing wrong with those postures, but it's how it's done. And I maintain that if you put the principles of Mr. Iyengar's guru, Krishnamacharya, into the principles that he brought forth from the great tradition, if you put it into all these styles that have been popularized in the West, then it turns it into Hatha Yoga. It makes it very powerful. It makes it entirely your own yoga rather than cleaving to a linear, some sort of future result for yourself and some muscular effort, some improvement in the body and the mind that you don't yet have. So it turns it into that, yeah.
Mark, on the question of that sort of started this thread around the idea that we're already there and we're already arrived, you know, we have a question from Bruce Cameron, who's asking you, Mark, how do you help us deal with the pain we feel with various political realities, whether they're in the United States or other parts of the world that are disturbing? What's your response to that idea that we're already there, we've already arrived?
Right, what a beautiful question. You do your yoga. No matter what is going on in the restrictive patterns of society, in its belief systems and so forth, and the present, you know, arising of that anachronism of white colonialism trying to, like, control the universe, and control each other and the sort of dumb tribalism, you know, all that stuff is, you know, each of us can be completely free. We are already in the natural state. You know, we can enjoy our life as it is, no matter what is going on in the limits around us. And I say, you know, it's, each of us can do that. It's just participate in life as it is. And then that will have its result in the politics of our time in due course. You know. So I think, you know, this individualized yoga practice is actually activism. It's what each of us can do in the midst of this, you know, the dreadful circumstance we find ourselves in America and everywhere around the world. So I'd say it's the worst of times, it's the best of times, you know, to distribute this technology of love, the technology of the embrace of life. So that's my answer to Bruce, is do your yoga, but not just any yoga, your yoga, direct right. intimacy with your life. See, so in this union of inhale with exhale, above to below, is... say, in the union of opposites, the source of opposites is revealed. And this, you know, this Hatha Yoga reveals the heart, the Hridaya, the Hridaya Shakti, the place where the power of life is flowing from. It was the first cell of life that appeared when we appeared through the male-female perfect union. And then there we were as one cell. And that cell is now blooming as the whole body. So we can now, you know, enjoy that, what we are, this heart, the nurturing flow from the heart in all directions as the whole body and the mind arising from that heart is a function of the heart, a function of life. And we can all do that, you know. And going back to the wonderful Ramana and all the other great teachers of our time and ancient time, it is that spontaneous recognition of any person who's residing in that place of the heart or the natural state of life itself. You see that in a person, it's like, whoa, there it is. I feel that. I feel my own condition. I feel my own reality. It's just that now yoga is what you do in response to that feeling. In response to having been inspired by a great person or a great book or a great mountain or a great river, you know, you feel it and you go, oh, okay, now what do I do? And as to Bruce's question, especially in the midst of very extraordinarily disturbed humanity, is like, do that yoga. And then get it out there, share it with as many people as possible and get them doing their yoga and use iPhones and you know, Androids. Get it out there to all people everywhere and adapt it to the unique needs of every person and, you know, have everybody do a practice, you know. That's why we put out these apps, you know.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's wonderful. I just wanted to remind folks again who are all dialed in to press star 6 if you have a question, and you can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. And we do have another question from David K., who's asking a question that I think you've touched on a little bit in your conversation with Fab. He says, much of the yoga world, whether in the East or West, emphasizes yoga as a process to achieve things. Some of these are health, fitness, subtle energies, yogic powers, enlightenment, and transcendence. Can you please share what your teachers said about these things? Also, it would be helpful if you can share your views about not using yoga as a way of trying to get somewhere with physical or mental gymnastics, but rather as a simple way of experiencing intimacy with what is given. And I think the deeper thread of that question is simply this idea of a pre-state versus a post-state versus the state that we're in right now.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, this David seems to have everything really it's a beautiful inquiry. Inquiries in the question itself. Beautiful. If you do your yoga and it's designed for you, for your needs, for your body type, age and health, you do it principally as connection. I'm always saying, you know, what we need is connection. We don't need spirituality, because the entire world of spiritual language is this idea of getting somewhere to some future possibility for yourself, which is the denial of the plain wonder that is already arising as yourself, as life itself, and the perfection of, you know, the skin, of the blood, of the brain, you know, of the breath, of the sex. You know, it's already perfected. And yoga is the connection to what is already perfected. It's not an attempt to get to some future perfection. You know, so stop looking, start living. Go for that connection and you know, forget the rest. And if you're doing your participation in the opposite, strength receiving, inhale, exhale, then sure, there are secondary results. You do get healthy. You do feel intimate with others, related. Your sexuality becomes the heart's activity, you know, becomes real, becomes the collaboration of male, female, whether that's same sex intimacy or opposite sex intimacy. It becomes the heart's action. So all of this arises. You might even say, so this so-called enlightenment arises naturally, but it's not something that you need to get to. There's no getting to it. So there are all these sort of like secondary results that arise spontaneously. And even meditation, is a Krishnamacharya described meditation as a siddhi. You can't meditate. You can't, the will of mind, the mind controlling the mind will never create meditation. This whole idea of mindfulness is actually creating a dissociation from our lives, because, you know, it implies, you know, the witness and everything that you're witnessing, you're separate from. So even that is problematic. But what we need is connection, not mindfulness. Connection to our lives as it is. So this is my thing. It's like, you know, please, everybody, learn an actual yoga practice and do an actual yoga that's right for you, and stop, you know, bullying yourself with, you know, these ideas of future possibilities for yourself in spiritual language. Do your yoga, and then arises as siddhi, or as gifts of a natural result, all the powers of life, including the ability of meditation, clarity in the mind, and health in the body, and intimacy with life in every way. It just comes. So, do your yoga, David.
Great. On that note, we have a question from Pancho as well. Let me see if I can get that active. Pancho, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. What wonderful. Good. Great to hear you, brother Mark.
Hello,
and
my brother.
It's great to see you. Just to maybe continue on that flow of where the conversation is going in terms of connection, just to share briefly that in the way that I met you was in this framework or this context of this connection, that it seems that yoga has been going towards more on not the so-called people of color in this part of the planet, and yet you were able to put together with our sisters Maya and Jana and Amit. I think Maya was in a for this Black Yoga Teachers Alliance here in Oakland, and I was really moved by this idea that you say again and again that there's yoga for every person, for every human being, for each body, for each type, that you don't need to do this mental or physical gymnastics. And as we speak, you know, my heart fills with joy, and I feel this connection. And also, as we speak, there's these brothers and sisters that might be coming together here in San Francisco to do these white supremacist or neo-Nazi, they call it, rally, just all these labels to describe this connection. Right now, as we speak, there's other people going there and trying to do something different and represent that part of love. So it's a little bit to poke on this European white colonialism that you so skillfully bring up with so much lightness and so lack of charge, and how it's manifested right now. And so why would you, I have a couple of like little questions here, or you know, poking your heart, and that is in the center of everything. That's the other thing that I love about you, how you bring that breathing in the heart. Like, why would you share, or would you share some examples of how yoga as a peace practice have made a difference in many different parts of the earth? And the other one that it really is just to rise right now, as I was listening to you and David and Rahul, is what would it be, say, a nonviolence, or what would it be, a way to disobey with great love, so to speak, for every person? In the same way that there's a yoga for every person, how can we exercise that muscle of nonviolence, or that muscle of disobeying with great love for every person?
Yeah. Yes. Thanks so much, my brother. And thanks for reminding me of this work that we do. We're sponsored by the Urban Family Foundation. We go out and we've been teaching yoga to Black yoga teachers around the world, and our Mideast Peace Project, where we're giving yoga to Islamic groups and Jewish Orthodox people and so forth, and helping everyone, you know, this understand and, you know, tangibly participate in the one humanity and the one reality that every human is in. You know, there's one human family that's literally, factually true, and we stop worrying about, you know, tribal warfare and all the rest of it, and protection of our little enclosed, isolated group, you know. So that's happening, and I just think there's this possibility now of getting, you know, through our second brain, the global interconnectedness that we now have in the world operating. We like push it out there to in the hands of every person, and that everybody can move and breathe in the way that's right for them and enjoy their intrinsic intimacy with life. And in that intimacy, then fear diminishes, anger diminishes, pain diminishes. You know, sure, there's grief for the bullshit circumstance that's been put on humanity, but it's necessary to come to that grief so that you can then have compassion for yourself and everybody else involved in this unnecessary circumstance that's been imposed on humanity, and grieve for ourselves and for everybody else, and come to compassion, come to forgiveness, and live our lives in intimate connection to life itself and with all other life arising. And this is a possibility now for humanity. And we have it in our hands. And this is why I'm saying yoga, individualized yoga practice, is the first act of activism. And it's the first human right. The first human right is to be intimate with your own life. And, you know, we must give this now to the people, and you know, thank you for your part in that. Like, let's get it out there robustly, you know, communicate with all manner and means that we have, you know, and on a local level, each yoga teacher everywhere, you know, giving it to their local community. And no matter what the background of the person, you know, the race and the cultural background, the religious point of view, or non-religious point of view, which is, you know, out there very much as there's all the, you know, the modern world has been finished with the whole idea of religion and so forth. Fair enough, you know, we'll their own good, valid reasons. Yeah. But give everybody yoga. Everybody. Because everybody wants to feel better, and everybody can feel better. Feel better and feel better. Two different sentences. You know, feel into life, feel into what life is. It's for everybody, all people. Thanks for reminding me of that Oakland event. It was so lovely.
Of course, brother. It was powerful.
Yeah.
Thank you, brother. Love you. And please share my love with Maja and Amy and Jana.
Yeah.
It was powerful to see these two black women leading us in all that. It was really special. So please share my love with them. And love you, brother.
Yeah, thank you so much. And keep it out there. Keep teaching in ever-widening circles. Now, that's why we put these apps out. I have an app called I Promise and another one called the Yoga Promise. And it's intended so that, you know, people in Africa and in Sudan and you know, Middle East and, you know, Iraq and Iran and everywhere that's Syria, everywhere that's suffering, like, you know, stand there, move and breathe in the way that's right for you and feel better and you know, start to be connected to life.
Sure. On that note, Mark,
I don't mean to be glib about the, you know, the dreadful conditions that have been put on us, people around the world. I don't mean to be naive about that. It is. It's dreadful. And there's a starting point of, you know, just for a moment feeling your intrinsic connection to life itself, no matter how difficult things are, and come to a place of compassion. There's a possibility now.
Thank you, Mark. On that note, Rita Banks from Chicago is asking, for someone just starting Hatha Yoga, someone who's already ready to be trained as a yoga teacher, but who is already deep on the spiritual path via meditation and other means, how would you recommend that one can begin to be trained in this yoga tradition with truly great teachers anywhere in the globe? Which teachers or programs do you recommend? And is it possible to learn from you as a pure beginner to Hatha Yoga?
Yeah. Beautiful question. Thank you so much from Chicago. And yes, the whole idea that I want to put out there is that there is now access to information without actually meeting a teacher. We put a book out called The Promise, just The Promise. It's a little handbook of the previous books. The Promise, subtitle, you can have what you really want. And the apps, the I Promise app and the Yoga Promise. So I think that they go a long way to explaining to individuals everywhere, how to start, how to begin an actual Hatha Yoga practice. And that's now there. And then apart from that, these retreats and workshops that we do around the world, of course, everyone's most welcome to come and to come to those gatherings of students, of the Sangha, the group of practitioners. And it's very helpful to be in those groups. And so we do that in Ojai in California at the home of J. Krishnamurti that happens in this November coming up, the 5th. And then Esalen I do on a regular basis, November the 11th at Esalen and January the 7th at Esalen. And we're doing a big one in Bali in March next year. So all of these are happening, and we want those. Most of all, I want people to come to those, and don't worry so much about finding your teacher. You become the teacher. You know, learn these basic principles and then begin to teach. We do need our gurus. We need our teachers in Chicago and all over. So this is what I recommend, that look at the media stuff first, and then come on out to some event somewhere. And everybody's welcome. And that is, you know, perfect beginners. I have a joke about, you know, my introductory courses, advanced yoga for perfect beginners. So everybody come, and there's people who are involved in spiritual practices or the yoga practices as they've been popularized. Come and put these principles of Krishnamacharya into the yoga that you know and love. And for people with meditative practices, it's great. And include a yoga practice as part of your meditation sadhana. So these are asana, pranayama, and meditation as a seamless process, where asana is very helpful to meditation. It makes meditation possible. It makes meditation stable. And has great profundity, and that asana is meditation and allows for the more passive aspects of meditation to arise naturally.
Right.
So to that lovely person in Chicago, they're most welcome.
Okay, wonderful. We got a question from Albert H. Rowe III in Sierras, who says, thank you for this shared space of exploring our stories and the energies of life. The word yoga, as most names, concepts, practices, and beliefs, seems to carry an energy of exclusivity, duality, limitation, and separation. Would you mind speaking to this? And I think you've sort of touched on it a little bit, right? It's this idea that we're already there, and then the response to, like, how do we deal with the things that feel separate and difficult is to do our yoga practice and we will feel better or heal better. So I wonder if you can kind of orbit a little bit closer into this paradox of, sort of we've already arrived versus kind of getting somewhere to like a better state or a better place or a more integrated place or whole place.
Yeah. Well, I'm always saying that whatever is arising is arising as truth itself, as life itself, and is all, even apparent limitation in the body or mind, apparent limited emotions, fear, anger, pain, grief, these apparent limits on us are arising in and as life itself, as truth, and nothing is to be denied. It's all, frankly, fear and anger is appropriate for this organism needing to survive, to look after itself. Fear is a legitimate response, in this world today. Like fear, you got to get out of the way, look after yourself. Anger is a response that's a necessary response to protect oneself sometimes. It's just that to be stuck in fear and anger as perpetual constant emotions is dangerous to our health and well-being. The idea is that you go through fear and anger to the pain that is beneath the anger. And pain is Mother Nature's means of healing the system. Pain is the nurturing force of life operating in us that is taking care of us. It means, take your hand out of the fire, Without pain, we wouldn't survive. And so pain is the healing. And so in yoga, we acknowledge all these emotions as being natural and necessary until we come to grief, and then we come to compassion, and then we come to forgiveness and live our life on the basis of direct intimacy with life, and not denying any of those what I call the hierarchy of emotions that life uses for its optimization. Even limit is arising in consciousness. Apparent limit, it's all right, We go through these stages and use the emotions that life is natural to life, but don't get stuck in any of it. So predict the next emotion coming along, if there's fear, predict anger? Does anger predict pain? Does pain predict grief? And go to grief as quick as you can. And go to compassion. Compassion arises naturally in the grief. But go to compassion. And I think we cultivate the ability to go there quickly. You can do it in a couple of seconds. You know, you don't have to prolong it. You don't have to go through years of one emotion necessarily. You just go to grief, go to compassion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and particularly for sharing the connection between grief and compassion. One sort of last question to close off our call. I'm curious about how we as the broader service-based community can support your work.
Well, you know, we're all doing the best we can with the information that we have at hand. And I think those of us in yoga and have an interest in yoga, we all know that you know, Krishnamacharya was the teacher to Mr. Iyengar, and we understand the story that Mr. Iyengar was just a boy when he left Krishnamacharya. You know, he had to go to Pune, and then he never had any further contact. And you could say he did the best he could, but these principles of Krishnamacharya got left out of the equation as the West popularized yoga. And so I just, you know, informed the yoga demographic of the principles of Krishnamacharya that he brought forth, and you know, be a conduit, let people know that there are the principles of the Tantra that can be put into the yoga that you know and love, that makes it entirely your own, that makes it efficient, powerful and safe. The union of opposites in your own system, in which the source of opposites is revealed, the heart is revealed, the flow of nurturing from the heart and into all relatedness is revealed. And enjoy that ourselves. I guess that's the way to support it. Enjoy that practice, that love, and pass it on to everybody else as quickly as we can. We've got to get the job done.
Right.
Let's get Om Sahana Bhavatu. Let's get the job done together.
Okay.
I think something is happening.
Yeah. We will certainly also share links to your site and to more information about you, including your apps, when we send out the thank you email. And on that note, we actually like to end the calls with a collected minute of silence, but this time in gratitude for all of the conditions that allowed this call to come together, including your tremendous graciousness in being willing to join us last minute at 4 a.m. from all the way from New Zealand. So we will hold a collective minute of gratitude in silence, and then I'll actually open up the line so that everyone can thank you who's dialed in with their voice.
Awesome.
So just 1 minute here.
Awesome. I send my love and my great gratitude to everybody here. So it's so lovely being with everybody in 1 minute of silence in this relationship that we have here, this togetherness. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you all. And I'm going to unmute everyone. Maybe on the count of three, we can all just say thank you, Mark, and just send our love from wherever we happen to be in the world all the way to New Zealand. So one, two, three. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Global.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.